Hello, and welcome to Unfrozen, episode number 76. I'm your co-host, Greg Lindsay.
And I'm Dan Safarik. Today, we are very excited to have on board Josh Komaroff, who is one of the authors of Horror in Architecture. You heard that right, Horror in Architecture. Josh is an assistant professor in the Urban Studies program at Yale NUS College in Singapore, and this is actually the second edition of this book. It is creatively subtitled The Reanimated Edition. I've been wanting to talk to you for quite a while, Josh, so thank you for being available.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on here with you guys.
So this is interesting. I think we first have to step back a bit and say, are we using the traditional definition of horror when we talk about architecture? Because there's quite a bit in this book that it has a lot of the expected references to cinema and to other media depictions. But I don't know if people are familiar with the concept of how horror would apply to architecture. Maybe we start there.
Yeah, we try and, I think, give a little bit of a historical survey around the concept of horror in the book. We kind of start with romantic philosophical theories of horror, people like Burke, people like Kant, kind of theorists of the picturesque and the romantic moment, and then try and bring that forward through into kind of modern and contemporary horror fiction, which of course then takes on kind of valences of pulp and other kinds of, you know, Hollywood media and all the sort of classic horror associations, I think, that we think of. I think in horror, we try and really attach the concept to architecture in a number of different ways. One, through a kind of concept of affect, right? Are there buildings that we experience in our day-to-day lives that do make us uneasy? What about them makes us uneasy? And what about architecture in particular is very good at communicating a sense of unease, or maybe communicating a sense of unease due to kind of underlying cultural or historical forces that we might find a little bit uncomfortable with, things like scale, for example, and other kinds of interestingly modern problems. The other aspect of horror that we're interested in, which is, I guess, a little bit lighter and a little more playful, is the comparison between buildings and elements of monstrosity, right? Elements of the monstrous. And this is, you know, probably more of a kind of a biographical thing. Xing and I, when we talk about architecture to our students and to each other and to the people we work with, very often wind up, for one or another reason, comparing buildings to monsters. And we started to ask this question around 12 or 13 years ago when we started to work on this book. Why is that? You know, what is it about buildings that seem accessible to monstrous metaphors? And it was really through the kind of exploration of that, really trying to, in a way, examine our own conversations, our own ways of speaking about architecture, that this book really came about in the first place.
All right, I have to jump in here and ask, what are some examples of comparing buildings to monsters? I'd love to hear your favorites.
Oh, well, some of them in the book, we talk about, for example, like gigantism. One of the things we're really interested in is the whole problem of scale, of buildings getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I was one of Rem Koolhaas' students at Harvard GSD. We were all very, very influenced by the Bigness essay when it came out, and really trying to understand what are the impacts? I mean, what are the things that are driving buildings into such kind of enormous sizes? And then, you know, concomitantly, certain spaces we occupy are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so we talk a little bit about giants. We also talk in this version of the book, although it was actually cut from the first edition of the book, but we talk about blobs. And we talk about puppets, buildings that are large, but kind of locally resemble small and familiar types of architecture in order to communicate better with people who find blobs maybe a little bit uncanny or unseemly. So these are things that we're very preoccupied with, especially because, again, we're rooted in Singapore, where, you know, our form of urbanism has increasingly taken on the guise of very large, containerized, quite monstrous blob-like buildings, which are in some ways kind of hard to navigate. They can be very peculiar experiences because one part can be completely different from another. And so in a way, these are also kind of our own preoccupations. The metaphors maybe capture a little bit the things that we're nervous about, maybe, or fascinated with, probably more accurately.
So there's quite a few examples in the book, and I'm not sure exactly which category they all fall under, but I can name a few of the buildings that make appearances here, and then maybe we can sort of say what specific condition of horror in architecture, as you've defined it, you know, inspired you to talk about this building in this way? I mean, I guess one sort of simplistic, I think more easily understood comparison is something like the Centre Pompidou, which turns its guts inside out, literally, as a building. It is like its organs are all visible on the outside. That's part of its poetics, of course, but, you know, if you think about it, that is actually what's happening. Is that an example of that you would refer to as an incontinent object, I believe?
Very much so. That's one of our favorites, actually. That was one of the buildings that led me to want to be an architect in the first place when I was wandering around Paris as an exchange student when I was a teenager. And definitely we're fascinated by, for example, you know, the notion of buildings that don't politely keep all of their stuff inside, right? They tend to kind of spill out. And that could be something like Pompidou, where there's a strange kind of inversion, right? The guts, as you were saying, kind of turn into the outside of the building and kind of confront us in an interesting kind of way. And there's some wonderful movies, some of which are horror, some of which are, I guess, are kind of horror adjacent, like, for example, Terry Gilliam's Brazil, in which, you know, the authoritarian state is constantly trying to hide things behind these kind of nicely rendered surfaces, but the guts, you know, this effusion of plumbing is constantly like bursting out and herniating and spilling everywhere, and it's kind of wonderfully gross but also kind of architectural at the same time. And it's kind of like the secret for us of a lot of modernism, and especially in, a lot in Asia that we've seen of kind of not very well reconciled modern building, where the guts aren't really tucked away very well and you constantly look up and see a kind of a plumbing chase or something coming down, hanging out or poking around a corner. So we're very interested in that kind of intrusion of these objects. And also because for a number of years, Xing and I were living in Shanghai during, 2001 to 2003, during a time when the whole city seemed to be kind of taken apart, like vivisectioned as we're, and you, so you'd kind of walk by and suddenly you'd see a building with no facade and only a partial floor, but, you know, the residents' photos and wallpaper and things were still kind of hanging on the wall. So the kind of problematic boundaries in Asian cities that are undergoing violent forms of transformation, where the interior is always a little bit too much on display, and there's a kind of a violence, not a literal violence, but a kind of a violence done to architecture, but then also that makes you wonder, what are the broader social conditions? What are the broader historical conditions? What has to happen in order for a building to kind of be presented in this kind of uncanny way?
Well, I just discovered we have something else in common. When we were talking before the podcast began, we determined that we are both from the Chicago area and have lived within blocks of each other at different times. I also lived in Shanghai for 2 years. And later, it was 2015 to 17, and noticed that I know exactly what you're talking about. I don't think the pace was quite as fervent by the time I got there, but the way that the authorities would just sort of plow through things and then insert newness into the oldscape. I mean, I think one of the most interesting examples of that is probably Xin Tiandi, which I think is mentioned in your book, where you actually took pictures of the destruction that took place. For those who are not familiar, this is an old neighborhood of Shikumen, which is the alleys that Shanghai is known for, these sort of long alley houses that are enclosed within courtyards, walls that surround on the broader blocks. And it's actually quite celebrated now as a sort of Congress of the New Urbanism kind of revivalist, you know, restoration, very commercialized, but restoration of the traditional Shanghai footprint. But of course, a whole bunch of demolition had to occur in order for that to happen. There's a lake there that wasn't there before, for example. That sort of recreation of historicism, where does that fall in your classification system?
Actually, Xin Tiandi was a difficult one for us because we wanted to put it in about 5 different chapters. And I think at one point, one of our kind of early critical draft readers was like, you know, you must be overly obsessed with this development because, you know, it just kind of kept popping up in the text over and over again. We were very interested in questions of, for example, architectural taxidermy, right? You know, like what happens when we keep a facade that by all intents and purposes, for all appearances, really looks like it's the original thing. And we can very easily be fooled by the kind of the careful preservation of it, by the sensitive way in which the old and the new are kind of recreated. But really what happened for much of that was just a kind of a hollowing out. right? It was kind of the opposite of the facade being torn off the building to expose the interior. In this case, the building was kind of gutted and kind of stuffed back with other kinds of things, you know, some of which were very, very kind of sensitively done, charming bars and things, but nonetheless, very, very different from the kind of collectivized domestic or residential architecture that would have been there before. And in other cases, it kind of just became a kind of a mask, you know, again, what we kind of refer to as a puppet in the book, a kind of way that a very big, almost Singaporean style kind of technical pudding of a mall, which no real kind of spatial or tectonic definition, that has this kind of mask in front, which is very charming and kind of extends this kind of benevolent face to you of kind of historicism and, you know, caution with respect to kind of heritage and this sort of thing. And then, of course, there's one little moment which was a very kind of historically significant building in the history of the Communist Party, which is kind of preserved entirely intact as this kind of interesting little kind of floating giblet inside that kind of very diverse kind of mix of things. We are fascinated by this kind of constant play between appearances and contents, between the kind of violent shifts of scale, not so much necessarily as critique. I mean, one thing that we encountered a lot when the original version of this book came out is that people assumed that we were saying that this was a list of kind of shameful, horrifying buildings, right? Kind of architectural mistakes and errors. And we spent a lot of time trying to explain that we love actually buildings of this kind. We love awkward buildings. We love buildings that try very hard and have a lot of problems articulating themselves, trying to figure out the quandaries that the architects had to kind of in a way work with in order to produce those buildings and kind of make sense of them in a particular historical context, particularly in moments where things seem to be transitional, right? Things are changing very fast. So as you can imagine, Shanghai in the early 2000s was a perfect example of that. In fact, the other book that Xing and I are working on now is a draft, which is a very intense drawing book, was that we spent most of our time there actually just going into buildings kind of two steps ahead of the bulldozers, with a team of Chinese architecture students drafting the way that people were increasingly managing survival, collectivization. So we went to, for example, a house where the government wanted somebody to leave, and the family didn't want to leave, and the government started removing roof tiles from one side of the roof to the other, and the family just moved their furniture over. You know, so they had this weird kind of gaping hole in the roof. And so the whole house, which was originally, I don't know, 20 meters wide, was starting to be compressed into smaller and smaller spaces. And what was interesting was they weren't just piling things up. They still kind of had a living room. It was just, you know, only a meter wide. And when you went in, they would greet you in this tiny little narrow sliver of space where it used to be, you know, a room kind of unto itself originally. So there are all these kind of interesting ways that architecture became a kind of a means of negative persuasion. In fact, a kind of almost like a means of abuse, but then also a means of resistance in the same way. And we find these kinds of buildings really powerful because it's not an architecture that tries to cover up or make nice or simply beautify or put a mask or a lie on a particular kind of problem that the architect faces. What the projects in this book have in common is that all of these are cases where there's a kind of a intentional or unintentional awkwardness that continues. And what's interesting about awkward buildings is that they so clearly kind of provide pointers, directions, almost a kind of a map or a heuristic for us to start to look for moments when we can see that there were these kinds of pressures put on the city, put on architectures of different kinds, put on architects. And we kind of love that detective work.
Well, take it in a slightly different direction, Joshua. I'm curious, like, the word uncanny is my favorite description of this one, too, because it sort of implies that there is perhaps, yeah, a visceral response, a subliminal response we have to buildings. And I'm curious how you would frame horror and architecture with some of the debates that rage online back in the States here, where the trads and the fascist trads are arguing about natural beauty in buildings, human scale discussions of Jan Gehl and others, and this notion, you know, I mean, which ranges all the way from, you know, brutalism is inherently bad and inhuman to other sort of venerations of trad building, which I think, you know, the romantic and the gothic actually sort of obviously is what your definition's rooted in. So I'm sort of curious, like, how universalizing is your descriptions of horror and architecture in this? Is there such a thing as an uncanny building, and are there principles of it that underlie uncanny buildings? Or is that being used as a trope by them to carry a political agenda sort of against, you know, modernism, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, we're kind of fascinated by exactly that question because, of course, like the argument that the Romantics, people like Burke, made about horror, first of all, was that it was a good thing. We all had to go and horrify ourselves because, unlike aesthetics, like problematic, flimsy things like beauty or ugliness, horror and the sublime would speak kind of straight to the soul. And it was a kind of an exercise of moral improvement, right? It was this kind of discourse that really permeated all of the stuff about the picturesque, about landscapes, about grottos, about certain kinds of ruins, follies, you know, that were designed in the landscape on all these wonderful kind of British stately home gardens to kind of horrify us in a good way. Almost the way that sort of we go to horror films now, perhaps, or we go to theme parks in a way to kind of, you know, to enliven or electrify, galvanize the soul, right? So in a sense, what's interesting about horror now is that when it's spoken about, I find that when people talk about horrifying buildings and that kind of trad discourse, it's entirely negative, right? The idea is that like horrifying things are bad. We should surround ourselves with beautiful things and good stories about ourselves. You know, I feel like it's very proximate to the kind of people who don't want to teach problematic aspects of American history because they make people uncomfortable. You know, there's a kind of an architectural analog to that. We're, I think, more of the older school in the sense that we really think that architecture making us uncomfortable is an important thing. You know, if all architecture is homely in the sense of the opposite of, you know, uncanny being unhomely, if there's something such as homely, we worry that there's a kind of a tendency toward being lulled into a false sense of complacency about the world. And what we like about buildings that make us uneasy is that we should be uneasy. The world has things that we should worry about. And so as a result, I think we are returning to a kind of a valorization of the uncanny. And this is something that, the reason we decided to write this in the first place, not only was because we found ourselves talking about monsters all the time, but because Shing and I share this incredibly intense admiration for Anthony Vidler's book, The Architectural Uncanny, right, which went back into Freudian theory. And in a way, I mean, had a whole wonderful kind of historical layer, which we benefited from tremendously, kind of was a justification of decon, right? The idea was that the uncanny was now being harnessed by deconstruction to make us very aware of a world that was itself deeply uncanny. And in a sense, we have taken aspects of that argument and brought them forward by looking at other things. I think that where this becomes really important in a way is in our localization, right? We are in Asia, where brutalism is kind of the architecture you can take home to mom, right? Everybody loves, we have pastel, beautifully pastel brutalism all over Singapore, and there's a massive, massive public upswell of opinion about preserving these buildings. The government doesn't like them, the people love them. And so what might have been kind of uncanny or unacceptable from a kind of American or Euro-American kind of trad perspective, actually in Asia, is really seen as a very important pivotal moment where we had a lot of post-independence architectural movements making very courageous, fascinating forms of architecture that we see tremendous value in. And when they start to disappear, we start to get uncomfortable. So, I mean, I think what's interesting, what we have to be very careful about is that there is no, unlike Burke, right, unlike the Romantics, we don't believe that there is a kind of a universal global human formula. And this is where, you know, I teach a class at Yale NUS on architecture and society, and one of our case studies is this is film called Built Beautiful. You probably see it. It's kind of it's these people arguing that there's a neurological formula for beauty, right? We used to be monkeys. We used to live in the trees. We like leaf-like, tree canopy-like complexity. We like kind of variegation of scale. You know, there are all of these things that are, you know, and I don't doubt that some of that research might be very telling and very important, but the argument that's taken away from this is that architectural diversity is very bad. And they say that, well, you know, the more years of modernist architectural education you have, the more your tastes tend to diverge from those of the public, the more you vilify Starbucks and, you know, you hate places like UVA and all these kinds of things that are not really true. What we're trying to kind of move away from in the book is the notion that there is any kind of stable sense of what the uncanny is. And when we look at it in different kind of contexts, then, for example, what might be seen in Shanghai by us as uncanny is seen by others as a mark of progress. And then by the people who live in the building, you know, a violent form of dislocation and a kind of expropriation of their own kind of means of production and their place of being in the world. So I think we are relatively agnostic and somewhat kind of anthropological in our orientation toward that question. I think we want to stay away from these kinds of universalizing arguments because, in a sense, it's almost impossible to believe those in Singapore. Just the differences of taste between what we see here and what we see back home in the U.S. is just too stark.
That's fascinating. I prefaced when we said that this interview was coming, that there would be two things that I found uncanny or unexpected that were major parts of my high school growing up in the 90s. One of them is Army of Darkness, and the other one is the mullet, in that I had one. So let's talk about the role that the mullet plays, and perhaps where the analog, the Army of Darkness, you know, there is a clone situation in that movie that is used to typify the clones.
I gotta say the quote, Dan. I'm good Ash, you're bad Ash. Good guy, I'm the guy with the gun. Like, I think that typifies a lot of it here. But yes, that my favorite Army of Darkness reference.
So take whichever you want to take first, mullet or Army of Darkness.
Yeah, the mullet is another interesting case. I always assumed, you know, that the mullet growing up again in the 90s in the Midwest, I mean 80s and 90s in the Midwest. I graduated from high school in 91, right? And mullets were, oh, you know, I mean, there was nothing redemptive about a mullet. There was not a situation that a mullet could kind of talk itself out of. Coming here, what I realized, you know, in Singapore, I spent a lot of time going to, you know, to talk in, you know, Melbourne and going to meet architects in Sydney. The Australians love the mullet. They still love the mullet. And they have all these incredibly innovative mullet variants that are a little bit more like Mohawks, a little bit more punk rock, a little bit more, say, kind of bogan, kind of more like our kind of hillbilly style. So even the uncanny aspect of the mullet has to be put in some kind of, I guess, global cultural kind of relativism or relativistic kind of perspective. But yeah, I mean, we were fascinated by it in a sense because, again, it's this question of seeing something that one finds kind of deeply uncanny and trying to, in a way, reverse engineer or kind of understand or perform a kind of an autopsy on, you know, what is it about that that makes us so uncomfortable? We talk about that in the context of what we call the ungrammatical body. You know, of course, Frankenstein's monster is one of, I think, the most applicable cases, especially in contemporary situations where so much of our architecture, so many of our buildings appear to be kind of pieced together with very abrupt lines of transition just due to some sort of raw, I don't know, development logic or whatever kind of commercial kind of masters that determine how the building turns out. So we have kind of two, right? We have the one where, like the Hanover Pavilion by MVRDV, where every floor is just a completely different thing. I think we compare that to an Arby's sandwich where, you know, each layer is its kind of independent kind of object, right? They're all very different. And what's interesting about that is the unmediated difference, right? And this is something, again, that we think that Kohlhaas and OMA have explored, and also MVRDV obviously explored with incredible energy, with very interesting kind of results, right? But then there's the other one, right, where some kind of element tries to unify all of these diverse parts. And for us, that was the mullet in a way. Although there are other examples in the book, the idea that, you know, there's hair everywhere, but it has such a different kind of morphological logic, right? The short, spiky hair, and that, what is it? Business in the front, party in the back, right? And just the fact that one thing that is common to an object can have completely different kind of logics of form is somehow really deeply uncomfortable. And so for us, there were a lot of buildings where we saw architects try to deal with problems of abrupt juxtaposition by giving, I don't know, some huge roof or some kind of facade treatment, something that's the equivalent in a way of the kind of texture and length of the hair. Its commonality of material is something that people kind of use often to varying degrees of success, I think, to kind of knit the building back together again. And sometimes, again, that's very interesting because what we're seeing there is a kind of either intentional or unintentional problematic of one building that's trying to be two things at once. And often when that seems to happen, there's a reason, right? Why don't we have just kind of beautiful, kind of harmonious sorts of buildings where everything has a common kind of formal language or vocabulary? Well, very often we can't. And we tend to love, in this book, I think, projects where architects have quite frankly allowed that tension, the difficulty of resolving something, to be very, very productive. So going to Ash from The Evil Dead, you know, that awkward moment where bad Ash is kind of sprouting out of good Ash, and you get sort of the movement between one person and then the kind of two-headed ogre and then the doppelganger, which, of course, is a huge subject right now. I mean, there are books just popping up everywhere about doppelgangers, from Naomi Klein's book to a few others. I think the New York Times had a list of doppelganger books about a week ago. And we're very worried about this for various kind of interesting kind of historical reasons. And so we get a kind of a full spectrum of kind of monstrosity there, the problem of the individual and the compromised kind of individual. And one of the projects we love in the book, and we were very happy to be able to include it, was a house by Johnston Markley that was designed for Ordos, the Ordos 100 project in Mongolia, Inner Mongolia. It's kind of an abortive architectural project, but they designed this exquisite house, which from certain sides looks like one and other sides looks like two. It's like ash in that, that awkward transitional moment. But what's great about it is that the building can kind of constantly be looked at and interpreted in different ways because the architects chose to keep that tension in play. And the reason they kept that tension in play is because they had to design a 10,000 square foot house for a Chinese family with one child. And they were trying to understand, what does it mean to have a house, especially as a kind of coming from an American standpoint, that was so large that it was almost like a small institutional building and yet was only expected to be a house. And they couldn't resolve that question of scale. I mean, it was almost like one house that had to then start to sprout into two or three or four because of its own size and because of the kind of wastefulness of such an enormously large program. And so instead of trying to fake that, trying to cover that up, they came up with this incredibly compelling solution to that problem. And interestingly, across the way from their house, Atelier Bow Wow had another house that was kind of trying to deal with the same problem. And we also were part of that project. We designed a house for Ordos too. And what we started to see in the presentations was a tremendous anxiety about what happens when a familiar typology, like a house, which in a way is so important, I think, to many of us, as a kind of also like in the Gaston Bachelard way, right, the kind of the structure of the self is, we all have fond memories of houses and domestic spaces. And here it was being so alienated by its own scale that they were really wrangling with this problem in a kind of fascinating way. So the house, which they call the house, it couldn't just be a house. It had to, in a way, be something between a house, something greater than a house, and at times could redeem that, and at times, had to fall into this condition of multiplicity, which they obviously found fascinating but also uncomfortable.
So, I mean, I think there's a strong through line, that interpolates between cinema and other forms of depiction and architecture. I definitely see like a through line between like the work of H.R. Giger and Zaha Hadid. And I'm not really sure who the inheritor of that that sort of sinuous kind of uncanniness is. But I guess I'd be interested to find out if you have kind of like a simplistic two-column list where you sort of say, this architect is the Martin Scorsese of architecture, or the Hammer films of architecture, for maybe a closer, that was the Stephen King, what I'm saying? I don't know if you have like analogs that you draw that carefully, or if you're hesitant to do that because of the differences in the approach to each discipline.
I think sometimes there is a very clear through line. I think the Ridley Scott, Alien, H.R. Giger, moving through into Zaha, moving through, I think, even into people like Thomas Heatherwick, elements of Bjark Ingels, projects in a way that attempt to kind of use sinuousness, definitely Calatrava, right? The overtly biomimetic projects that are not biomimetic in the way that they perform. They're not analogically biomimetic. They are morphologically biomimetic, right? They look like skeletons. And I mean, there was that story we heard in architecture school. I don't know if this is true or absolutely made up, but that Calatrava had a dog skeleton on his desk, and that some of the structural sections and the ribs and so on that eventually found their way in the projects were taken or inspired by that skeleton that kind of sat there with him. There is definitely a moment of that. And I think that in a way there are two variants there, right? There is one where we start to see very literal shaping, and then there are others perhaps with things like Heatherwick's Zeitz Museum in Cape Town, where there's a kind of an extraction of silos. And again, we start to see kind of ribs and things that are made through a kind of stereotomic process of like cutting and removing, which is, again, probably more like sort of akin to Gordon Matta Clark or somebody like that, right, where buildings are cut up and sectioned into things. But again, that becomes an interesting kind of crossover line. And I think what's interesting thing about monstrosity is we can definitely see through lines, but the through lines are constantly kind of crossing in different kinds of ways. So we have blobs, right, which have this sort of amorphous kind of free-form surface, people like Jan Kaplicki and Future Systems and a little bit of stuff from Gehry, although he had a very limited, I think, flirtation with actual blobs, but like parts of the Experience Music Project. And then through the kind of looseness of organization, then we get things like piles, right, the whole kind of parametric group form thing of lots and lots. It's kind of modularity plus like advanced computation, right? Buildings that have a lot of kind of small units that pile up in ways that start to kind of simulate a kind of a free form shape, but not using curves, but using in a way things like cubes and stacked layers and things like that. So people like Francois Roche, Zaha also is here. Definitely Frank Gehry has his kind of his piles. I think he has more of those than he has like kind of literal blobs. And then we have a kind of a whole section, I think, of Frankenstein's monster heirs, right? We have all of the Dutch architecture of the 1990s. And this for me is, you know, as kind of an ex-student of Kohlhaas and somebody who went to the GSD from like 95 to 2000, like this is powerful stuff. This is kind of, you know, the architecture in a way that I really love. But the notion of, you know, collage of various kinds, whether that's something like the Parc de la Villette, or like MVRDV's work, whether there are attempts to kind of cross it back, you know, with a common element, sort of like we see at the High Line in New York, where there is a kind of a collage happening, but then the frame of the old infrastructural line in a way sort of starts to unify that back together. So I think we definitely have a Frankenstein trajectory. We definitely have a biomorphic trajectory. We have scalar problems. You know, we have buildings that kind of expose their interior or open themselves up. And then I think we have a lot of projects that start to devolve into various forms of anamorphosis in a really interesting way. I mean, one of the things that we find very fascinating about malls in Singapore is like the outside envelope is just very often a collection of logos. You know, there's just, it's shiny, it's often kind of metallic or it's glazed. And then the inside is just a whole series of anamorphic moments where you can be standing here and you could be looking into like a French bakery from 1920, and you could turn to the side and then, you know, you're looking at a kind of Southeast Asian style kind of food center with all of its kind of, all the verisimilitude of tiles and old signage and, you know, ducks hanging and, you know, all of that kind of paraphernalia. So there's also, I think, this moment of not so much collage, but just moments where one is inside a large system that has no totality. It just has lots and lots and lots of really fascinating, compelling moments that are designed to just make sense, each in its own kind of register.
I mean, I could do this all day and just quiz you on, you know, okay, this architect, what category does he fall under or she fall under? I don't know if that's the kind of level of classification that you're looking for, but I just love that you have really made an effort to come up with a vocabulary for the things that we see and terminologies that are not, they're not specifically architectural, they're not specifically cultural, but they're somewhere in between. Because I feel like one of the reasons architecture seems, I don't know if uncanny is the way that it seems to the public, it seems inaccessible to the public, is because we don't know how to describe what we're seeing. And I like that this book sort of creates a little bit of a bridge between the way that the, let's say, layperson or say the, you know, the horror movie fan would describe architecture that they're seeing. Do you feel like that a glossary is forthcoming? Because I feel like it's gone halfway toward that, but maybe we don't want to get too deterministic.
That's a really fascinating question. Originally, one of the things we really struggled with when we did the first version of the book is that we had this kind of map, a kind of typological map in which we were trying to fit projects. And I drove myself crazy because there were so many projects or so many buildings that just couldn't go into one and couldn't go into the other. And, you know, while clones and doubles kind of had an adjacency, then, you know, did we then think about something like the Trojan horse, right, where the interior is very different from the outside to a worrying degree. I mean, to the point where we could get something like Bret Easton Ellis's American Psycho, right, where the most kind of normative, conservative kind of Wall Street guy on the inside is just this demon, right? I mean, is that a kind of a doubling where the inside and the outside are different, or are we talking more about forms of kind of fractal reiteration, right? So we drove ourselves crazy just moving projects around. And in a way, we didn't quite get there. I think, you know, having a glossary or a map would be a great thing to have in some kind of future forthcoming edition. But you're absolutely right. I mean, what we are trying to do here with the kind of central section of the book, which we call Typologies of Horror, is really trying to just have a kind of a language that helps us start to place projects in some kind of a helpful taxonomy for exactly the reason you're saying. I mean, Xing is always saying that the big problem with architecture is a problem of translation. We have this kind of arcane kind of system of legibility. You know, buildings speak to us, and they speak to us very strongly. And then we have such a hard time in certain ways translating that to the public. And very often when we talk to clients, it's like almost like converting ideas into like unique selling points, right? Like ideas that might be emotive to them, but are kind of outside of languages of form that architects would use if we describe the same project, like say to another architect, for example. So a lot of what we found helpful about the book in a way was trying to kind of come up with a language that would allow us to speak to non-architects about buildings, and especially about buildings that made us feel a certain level of unease. Like if we had to talk about it, how would we do that? And that was a very interesting, that had kind of an interesting origin. I mean, that goes back actually, I blame that on Toshiko Mori at the GSD. So I remember when we would sit in classes, she had this amazing habit of comparing student projects to things. I remember one day there was a student that had kind of opened a building and it kind of like almost like split and opened. And she said, oh, it's like a fillet. You know, she was always comparing things to food or to animals. And somehow there was something incredibly helpful about that. I mean, and to us, the idea that architecture had to retain a kind of autonomy, a kind of a cool distance in which it only spoke its own language in its own terms, was less compelling than being able to say, oh, it's like a fillet, or it's like an Arby's, you know, breakfast sandwich, or it's like, you know, so in a sense, what's happening here is a kind of development in a way of that interest, right, of how do we talk about architecture through analogies in a way to break it out of a silo of a kind of highly professionalized discourse in order to communicate desperately to other people what we find so meaningful and so important and so persuasive and so powerful about this thing that we love, which is very frustrating in some sense because I've tried so many times, even with close family, to explain why I was fascinated by or loved or hated a building. And I just didn't have the words to do it. I could only revert back to forms of kind of what we call weaponized jargon, right? Kind of archibabble. And that wasn't doing anything. It just didn't work.
I remember taking a friend through downtown Los Angeles and showing him Morphosis's California Transportation, or Department of Transportation? Yeah, building, which has a lot of sharp edges and, you know, kind of discontinuous or facades that kind of exceed the edge of the building, and it's very pointy and sharp. And he just looked at it and he goes, this building hates me. I was like, yeah, I know what you mean.
I remember having this interesting conversation with Scott Cohen in Ordos, actually, during the time that those projects were, you know, we would go and show our projects and Ai Weiwei would love or hate them, right? It was a kind of it was like a yummy, yucky kind of jury. And I remember I was really frustrated by a Libeskind building that I'd seen that I had to teach. And I remember Scott saying, but it's just amazing that he gets the lay public to accept this kind of architecture, these pointy buildings. He gets the public to see value in this stuff that is so obviously, in a sense, kind of hostile. And he just thought that was a marvelous kind of piece of communication that one could talk to people like that. I mean, that stuck in my mind in a way as we were, you know, maybe looking at a cover like this where we have this very pointy building right here on the cover, something kind of compelling to take away.
Well, before we wrap up, I want to double back and go to one of my favorite images in the book and obsessions, which is, I can't remember the specific example you use, but the trope of buildings almost collapsing into themselves, of sort of their interior space. Because the two examples that immediately came to mind for me was the end of Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen series, where the Antichrist is hiding out in a space between two buildings. And then the scariest book that I've ever read is Mark Danielewski's House of Leaves, where the entire plot is triggered by the fact that there is a house that is bigger on the inside than it is on the outside, and it just opens up into this, you know, gothic, horrific world where its purpose is sort of unknown. And I'm sort of curious, you mentioned this earlier, the sort of the blob architecture of Southeast Asia with smaller interior spaces, but there does seem to be something about that as well in terms of spaces that open up into themselves deep within or seem to have their interiority and exteriority out of scale with each other almost somehow.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And one of, I guess the example of that I like the most is in the Bulgakov novel, The Master and Margarita, right, where they go to the devil's apartment, and it's a kind of a Stalinist kind of, you know, typical kind of Soviet apartment, but it's enormous, and the inside has a staircase that goes up like an opera house, but it goes up so far that nobody can see the end of it, right? And so the idea was that, you know, that the power, the kind of Faustian power, was to be able to kind of dislocate the inside and the outside. This is kind of like this power of infinite space making. And we're definitely, Shing and I are both really fascinated by that, especially by depictions of that kind of satanic spaces in architecture that are either kind of imploding or expanding, but what they're not doing is obeying the exterior envelope of the building, right? The power there is about a power of very irrational forms of dislocation. I was teaching part of Deleuze and Guattari's Anti-Oedipus just recently to a bunch of students, and they talk about that, right? That the ultimate power, the kind of most savage or vicious form of power, is just the ability to kind of enforce the absurd. And I kind of feel that way often, you know, in contemporary politics with a lot of kind of these forms of populism where you're like, how could people possibly believe that? How could anybody possibly argue that? And the whole point is that nobody in their right mind could possibly make that argument. But if you can force that, then it's an extraordinary form of power. And we talk about that also in this book in a couple of different ways. One is about kind of scalar transitions. They're definitely imploding buildings like the House of Usher, Poe's House of Usher. And at the same time, there are these weird dislocations. Like we were looking a lot at dictators' homes, the way that, for example, Saddam Hussein used this kind of almost Frank Frazetta-like kind of kitsch 1970s. I mean, not that Frazetta is kitsch, but Hussein's ones were really kitsch, where they were kind of like sci-fi fantasy illustrations with lots of buxom women and djinns emerging from things, and they were all done using kind of false perspective, like anamorphic techniques that actually made the interior of the building look like it was being invaded by kind of supernatural forces, you know, or like where Idi Amin just decides in the middle of, you know, that particular context in which his palace was built to kind of build this Chinese garden because he was showing that he had kind of successfully courted kind of Chinese money and Chinese power. You know, so the ability to kind of take a space and just shift it, you know, in space and time to another location, which makes in a way no sense whatsoever, seems to have this incredibly forceful, kind of undeniable power that is inspiring and also kind of terrifying. And then we see kind of more benign versions, like, you know, I think we talk about the great basilica in Yamoussoukro, which is like kind of a replica of St. Peter's, but I think it's 110% of St. It's just a little bit bigger than St. Peter's, and it has elevators, and it has air conditioning, and, you know, and it sits there kind of in the middle of this almost kind of quite alien parterre, the sort of like French formalist landscape that's literally kind of hacked out of a kind of equatorial landscape. And it's just fascinating to kind of see manifest how architecture there so clearly embodies and expresses just the sheer enormity and absurdity of that kind of power. Another good devil one, by the way, is in The Day of the Beast. There's a Spanish film. The devil lives at the top in the penthouse of one of Philip Johnson's kind of two leaning towers in Madrid. You know, that are kind of at the, I think it's farther to the south end of the city. But like they actually filmed it, I think when the buildings were still under construction. The buildings lean at this kind of impossible angle. It's like a bridge where the two sides don't meet, and the devil lives just like right at the top, you know. So there's something about, I guess, architectural absurdities or impossibilities that seem to kind of underscore these kind of unearthly powers.
We are living in perhaps one of the most absurd, unearthly, and perhaps disassociative times that any of us can recall. So I think, you know, even though this book is reanimated, as you say, from 10 years ago, it's quite timely that it's coming forward again. And I'm looking forward to see what other kinds of forms of classification you can help us use to navigate the uncanny valleys of reality. Josh, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's quite late in Singapore. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much. It's been a lovely conversation.